ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID, the Future, it's the second half of Stephen C. Meyer's conversation with Pat Flynn about Meyer's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Flynn, a philosopher who hangs out on the web at chroniclesofstrength.com, asks Meyer about cosmological fine-tuning, about the status of ID as science, and just what is it anyway that's got the naturalistic evolutionist so bothered about intelligent design?
The only other objection I can think of that would throw at you at that point would be something. Remember, yeah, Quentin Smith, right? I guess somebody like him would argue this is just a highly irrational way for God to do something, right? Like, it's just so improbable that God would do it this way, or it's too improbable that it would lead to life, that it just seems just ridiculous, irrational that God.
I don't think those probability, whatever he has in mind as far as probabilities are, I think are intractable for one thing.
I agree.
You know, it's oddly, I mean, one of the money quotes that I use in the book, which I do appreciate these new atheist guys a lot, because first of all, they really do have a point of view. They want to defend it. They want to know what's true. They're interested in the deep questions. But secondly, they have a talent for framing the issues. And Dawkins has said that the universe has exactly the properties we should expect if at bottom there was no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, which is a metaphor for matter in motion, matter and energy and nothing else, right? No mind, no purpose, no intelligence. And what that implies is that metaphysical hypotheses, his hypothesis of scientific materialism in particular, metaphysical hypotheses are testable or can be rationally evaluated by observing the universe around us and seeing if it has the properties that would be expected if a given metaphysical hypothesis were true. Yeah. So, right, I agree with that. I don't think there's a bright line between metaphysics and science. I think that both scientific theories and metaphysical hypotheses can be evaluated and tested rationally by observation.
Yes.
But what I do is I take Dawkins on, because I don't think any scientific materialist expected, certainly not before the 20th century, a finite universe. It was axiomatic and part of scientific materialism that the universe was eternal and self-existent. Remember the Carl Sagan mantra in the cosmos, the universe is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. Mm-hmm. Well, modern cosmology has discovered that the universe has not always been here. That was an unexpected result. So was the discovery of the fine-tuning, and so has been the discovery of digital code at the foundation of life. And one of the ways you know that these discoveries are unexpected on a strictly materialistic or naturalistic worldview is the elaborate auxiliary hypotheses, elaborate and convoluted auxiliary hypotheses that have to be constructed to, quote, save the appearances.
To reconcile
these observations with a naturalistic worldview. So what you get are multiverses, you get imaginary time,
You get the
alien designer hypothesis. Mm-hmm. This looks like a worldview in its death throes. You know, this is what happens as Thomas Kuhn and Lakatos put. You know, when paradigms and research programs start running into trouble, they get more and more convoluted explanations to try to explain and ad hoc explanations to explain things that can be explained very, very simply on the basis of an other framework. And I argue, especially when I'm talking about the fine tuning, that the theistic design hypothesis, the postulation of a transcendent intelligence, is much simpler in the Occam's razor sense of not multiplying theoretical entities than something like the multiverse, which not only posits billions of other universes out there, but also two different universe generating mechanisms, one based on string theory, one based on inflationary cosmology, each of which commit the postulator to multiple purely theoretical entities or postulates that cannot possibly be observed.
Yeah, so I definitely want to talk a bit about the multiverse, but I want to highlight something you said, which strikes me as sometimes missed, but very profound, right? And that sort of what we're working with here is this very basic degree of expectation, right? Like if this hypothesis is true, what would we expect versus if this other hypothesis is true, what we would expect. Now, in some sense, like if theism is true, like what's the probability that the universe would have a beginning? Like, put Revelation aside. I don't know, but I'm quite confident that if the universe had a beginning, even if I would assign a low probability to it, the ratio of that probability being more probable in theism than naturalism, right, definitely favors the theistic hypothesis.
Really,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. I do. I developed exactly that argument in chapter 12 in the book. I'm indebted to Tim McGrew, who's an excellent
good friend of mine. He's been on the show a number of times.
Okay, yeah. Right? Well, yeah. Tim is just a brilliant guy, and you know, philosopher of science, Western Michigan, and a very deep epistemologist. And he's got a lovely example to illustrate exactly your point. He says, and I appropriated it with his permission in the book. Imagine, and the point is that you don't need to be able to assign precise probabilities to do a Bayesian probability calculus, to apply Bayesian probability calculus to evaluating competing hypotheses, that sometimes you can know the ratios of your expectations. You can know that one thing is more expected on a given hypothesis than on another, even if you can't assign exact numbers to those, to that more than or less than.
Okay? Right.
So he gives an example. You're walking through the woods, you're a hiker, and you come across a ramshackle little cabin in the woods, and it looks like it's been abandoned forever. So your initial assessment is, that looks like an abandoned cabin. So you formulate in your mind the abandoned cabin hypothesis. But then you walk in, and there's a teapot, and it's steeping, and there's some water running in the sink, and there's some dirty dishes. And then as you listen more, there's a shower running in the back bedroom. And as ramshackled as the place looked like on the outside, you now realize that the place is likely inhabited. So all the new observations you've made make the inhabited cabin hypothesis much more likely to be true, and because the things you're seeing are much more expected on the cabin hypothesis than they would have been on the inhabited hypothesis than the uninhabited hypothesis. Now, prior to walking into the cabin, you couldn't have assigned an exact probability to how likely it is that you would have found a steeping teapot or dishes in the sink. I mean, but once you find them, you certainly know that it would be more probable to find those things if the cabin were inhabited than were it not. You know, and so I use similar. Of course, if you're a biblical theist, you have a very good reason for expecting a beginning to the universe, because the first words of the Bible are in fact in the beginning, and you have other affirmations of that concept in other parts of the Bible. Yeah. But if on just basic theism, you can't make a specific calculation as to how probable it would be that the universe had a beginning or not, but the comparative you do have more reason to expect it given theism than you do naturalism, because naturalism wants to say that the universe is eternal and self-existent, and it's axiomatic within that worldview system that the universe is the prime reality from which everything else came.
Right.
So anyway, so the discovery of the beginning is something that's more expected on theism than on naturalism, and therefore it confers more support on theism than on a naturalistic metaphysical hypothesis.
Right. Okay. Well, let's consider one more data point. This is absolutely fascinating, and that it's a significant one. And this is the anthropic coincidences, right? The fine tuning.
The fine tuning.
And I think this. I just think this is such an incredible thing. But there are, of course, loopholes and ways that people try to get around this. So again, do you want to just
the common sense interpretation of first of all, just for those who may not
know what are we even talking about?
Yeah, right? It refers to the fundamental parameters of physics, the strength of gravitational force and the other fundamental forces like electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear forces, the masses of quarks, the force driving the expansion of the universe that we were talking about before, the cosmological constant, an accepted value for the fine tuning of that is 1 part in 10 to the 90th, which means that if it were a little bit stronger or a little bit weaker in either direction by just a tiny smidgen that you would have to measure with these amazingly precise exponential numbers, the universe would have either blown apart or gone into a heat death, or it would have recollapsed. And you have this So sometimes physicists will refer to the universe as the Goldilocks universe, that the forces are not too strong, not too weak, the masses are not too heavy, not too light, the speeds of things not too fast, not too slow. Everything is just right to allow for the possibility of life, for a life conducive universe. And the question is, what do you make of that? I had an interview with Sir John Polkinghorne, the Cambridge physicist, whom I was fortunate enough to get to know when I was a wet behind the ears grad student in Cambridge. And he used to ask his audience, what do you make of it? But I asked him that one time. He said, I don't say that the atheists are stupid, but I do say that theism provides a more satisfying explanation.
Very polite and way to
very British, yeah. And Fred Hoyle said, a common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry, and there are no blind forces worth speaking about. So fine tuning, from a common sense point of view, points to fine tuner. And I kind of explain why that is too in the book, but we can get into that.
Yep.
Alternatively, people have said, well, okay, but maybe there's nothing to really to explain, because if we didn't live in a universe with finely tuned parameters, we wouldn't be here, and therefore would it. But yes, that's true. It is true that fine tuning is a necessary condition of our existence, but that doesn't explain the cause of the fine tuning itself, nor does it explain why the fine tuning is so incredibly improbable. That we did not have a right to expect on naturalism. Mm-hmm. So that's one that's called the weak anthropic principle. The more popular alternative explanation today is called the multiverse, where you posit these gabillions of other universes. I've already mentioned that I think it's a far less simple hypothesis in the Occam's razor sense of avoiding unnecessary multiplication of theoretical entities. But it has another problem. In order to portray our universe as the lucky winner in a grand cosmic lottery, which is what the multiverse hypothesis does, where we just happen to be the lucky one, the multiverse proponents have to posit a universe generating mechanism or mechanisms. Mm-hmm. If conversely, we just have these different universes out there that were causally disconnected from each other, then things that happen in other universes would have no effect on what happens in our universe, including whatever process it was that fixed the fine tuning parameters.
Yeah.
So you need an underlying common cause, a mechanism that allows you to portray our universe as the outcome of a randomizing process. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the two different common causes or universe generating mechanisms that have been proposed are based on different abstract speculative cosmological models. One inflationary cosmology, which is perhaps less speculative, more cosmologists accept that. And the other is string theory. Mm-hmm. And you need both of them because each explains different classes of fine tuning that the other doesn't.
Sure.
Okay. But here's the rub. Both of these universe generating mechanisms require prior unexplained fine tuning and very exquisite degrees. And so the fine tuning is not actually ultimately explained by the multiverse. It's just pushed out of view.
That's right. I love the quote from your book. You were quoting somebody else who said it's like digging a Grand Canyon to fill a hole, right?
Well, that's right. It relates to the use of inflationary cosmology, because some of the fine tuning that's required with inflationary cosmology is actually worse than it is with standard Big Bang cosmology.
Right.
So
the point is that at
worse or better, you know, more acute. Yeah.
Right. We just push the difficulty back, right? Or right. up or out or somewhere. Like we haven't resolved the difficulty. We've just relocated
from a naturalistic point of view. And yet, or instead, we do know, however, of a cause of fine tuning. What we mean by fine tuning generally, when we say a system is finely tuned, whether we're talking about a Swiss watch or a internal combustion engine or a French recipe, we mean a system or event that relies on multiple improbable parameters that are set in a particular way, so that jointly some functional outcome is achieved or some set of functional requirements are exemplified. So whether we're talking about the French recipe or the internal combustion engine or the Swiss watch or a number of other things that we would naturally describe as finely tuned, those types of systems always have one thing in common. They are the result of intelligent agency.
Yes.
So that's the reason it's a common sense interpretation. Fine tuning points to fine tuner. So the multiverse, insofar as the multiverse doesn't explain the ultimate source of fine tuning, it follows that the best explanation for the origin of the fine tuning, whether it's the fine tuning that we observe or whether it's the fine tuning that is implied in a multiverse. In other words, even if the multiverse is true, you still have strong evidence for intelligent design.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, as we finish up here, Dr. Meyer, and this has been utterly fascinating. Thank you for this conversation. Okay, maybe so we'll grant this. Okay, maybe theism better explains the data for just making an inference to the best explanation. Maybe that's true, but should we allow this in the domain of science? Because here's a common objection to ID, like, what predictions do you have for us? What fruitful predictions would adopting this sort of metaphysical hypothesis give us, right? Will this yield scientific fruit, right? If we go from being a naturalist to a theist, right? What's the upshot there, if any, scientifically, right?
Well, that objection has two forms. One is the objection directed specifically at the scientific theory of intelligent design, and I do defend the scientific status of intelligent design. It uses the same method of reasoning that Darwin used in The Origin of Species, and I think we should be open when we're talking about causal origins to two different possibilities: the systems that we're looking at were the product of undirected materialistic processes, and or they may have been the consequence of creative intelligence.
Certainly.
And since we have methods for detecting the activity of intelligence, and I discuss some of those in the work of William Dembski and others in my book, there's absolutely no reason to preclude consideration of creative intelligence. In fact, we don't do it in many fields, like in forensic science or archaeology. On the one hand, I think when we're talking about just the straightforward theory of intelligent design, there's absolutely no reason to preclude it. There's every reason to include it, because otherwise you have a sub-rational form of discourse where you've excluded a possible explanatory hypothesis a priori without even considering whether the evidence is there to support it. If you walk into the British Museum, you see the Rosetta Stone. And if someone asks you where did all those interesting inscriptions come from, and you say, well, it must have been wind and erosion. I'm a methodological naturalist, after all. I can't consider creative intelligence. That would be obviously a sub-rational inference, because we have information, we have knowledge of the cause and effect processes of the world that suggests that there is a much better explanation, scribes, yes. You know, intelligence.
Right.
Now, as for, you know, pushing this as far as I do in this book to say that we can go beyond the scientific hypothesis of intelligent design simpliciter to something I'm quite happy to call a metaphysical hypothesis, namely theism.
Right.
Is that a science stopper? Well, I think we need to look to the history of science there to answer that question. It certainly wasn't a science stopper for Newton or Boyle or Kepler. It was the inspiration for science. And I list, you know, at the end of the chapter where I defend intelligent design and my theistic design hypothesis against the charge of being a god of the gaps argument, I show that theism has a great record of being a science starter. This was the early modern science. Scientists wanted to show the glory of God. They did that by describing the mathematical harmony and regularities that they found in nature. They did that by describing the design they found in specific systems. And understanding that design has been a great impetus to science. Understanding mathematical harmony and regularity has been a great impetus to science. As far as the specific program of intelligent design, I could give you a number of examples where ID is being used in biology to generate new and testable hypotheses. In other words, it's being used as a heuristic guide to discovery. One simple obvious example is the whole discussion of junk DNA, which was thought, in fact, to be junk. The 97% of the genome that doesn't code for proteins was assumed by neo-Darwinists to be a consequence of the random trial and error process of mutation and selection. It's something they expected. We said, as our British friends say, hang on. If the system were designed, yes, we would expect to see some degradation of the original informational endowments of the organism, because we do accept that mutations are real processes, but we would not expect to see 97% of the genome as junk. That we wouldn't expect the noise to be dwarfing the signal. We'd expect the opposite. So we predict that the non-coding regions of the genome will be shown to be importantly functional. And work that was done early in the 2000s by Richard Sternberg and Jim Shapiro, and then later the ENCODE project, have amply confirmed that ID prediction. And there are other similar programs of research going on now in bioinformatics, some of which we're supporting, looking for what are called, in computer science, design patterns. And we're finding those things that you would expect if an intelligent agent had designed the information storage and processing systems that work in living organisms, including an interesting design, an ID-generated hypothesis about the presence of what are called overlapping genes as a way of maximizing informational storage capacity. And this has been conducted by a laboratory in Germany by an ID-friendly researcher there. And he has, in fact, found what he predicted on the basis of ID. So if you think that the organism was a design system, there are certain things you would expect to find that you wouldn't expect to find if it were the product of undirected, unguided processes that it had worked from a bottom up to produce things gradually. So there are discriminating predictions between the two models. And it's perfectly possible to do science within an ID framework. And not only an explanatory science of facts we already have, but also a predictive science that's going out and looking for new evidence to that would either support or disconfirm the framework of intelligent design as a way of looking at life.
Yeah, that is really excellent. You know, one last thing, and then I want to make sure we mention how people can get this excellent book of yours, is, and I don't want to get too much into the armchair psychology here, but it's always like kind of made me wonder, like, Why do these ID guys get so much vitriol, right? Like they're patient, they're thorough, they write 600-page books with the most contemporary research. They're giving very good, certainly at least plausible arguments, and they're often insulted and ridiculed and called things that they clearly aren't. Like creationists is like a derogatory term, and then it just kind of struck me as like, you know, take like, and I mentioned this.
But that one doesn't bother me so much, Pat. It's the creationist in a cheap tuxedo. That's the one that really gets under my skin. I pay a lot for my tuxedo.
It's not a cheap one. It's not cheap, all right?
It wasn't
Dr.
cheap.
Jerry Coyne, it's not cheap, all right? But yeah, so I mentioned this to Dr. Behe, and it's like, you're just like a really interesting threat. In a sense, like if what Dr. Behe says about like that sweet little bacteria flagellum, if what he says is right, like, naturalism is pretty much done for, you know, like it's like such an obvious thing. And like Alvin Plantinga talks about this. He's like, especially when it comes to evolution, like this is the only game in town, for the naturalist. So like, if there are good critiques of this theory, like boy, and is that castle like clearly like in the air, right? And I think they realize that deep down, right?
One of my friendly debating partners, Michael Ruse, who's a gem of a guy. And I've had many interactions with him going back to my first year out of grad school where we were on opposite sides of a podium, and he took me aside afterwards and gave me a lot of good advice, you know, as a more senior philosopher of science. I've always appreciated him, but he's a committed naturalist. But he says that he's written an important book where he says that evolutionary theory, evolutionary biology, specifically Darwinian evolution, has functioned as something like a secular religion for many of his colleagues. And so the very human reaction that people have when you're challenging Darwinian theory, you're challenging in the minds of the people on the opposite side of this discussion, you're challenging something like their religious beliefs.
It's very sacred, yeah.
And so the pushback we get is very understandable. I mean, this is a human reaction. You're challenging deeply held convictions that are fundamental to people's worldview. And they're essentially religious convictions for people on the other side of the naturalism theism debate. So, I mean, I understand that. I feel the same way when people challenge my beliefs. And so, you know, we can cut everybody some slack in this. What I love is the people who, on both sides, who are willing to have these discussions.
Right.
I feel a certain kinship with people, whether they're on the theistic or the naturalistic side, who are willing to look at these deep issues and ask the most important questions. So that's why I love, Dawkins, I think I completely disagree with his metaphysics, but I love the way he frames the issues and that he engages them with the kind of, you know, intensity that he does.
Yeah. Well, certainly what I can invite people to do is go look at the arguments and read the books, on both sides for yourself and see who you think has the, who has a better case. So with that in mind, Dr. Meyer, where can people get this book? And again, I can't give it a high enough endorsement. I learned so much about like string theory. And like, I think if you're just interested in contemporary science, you're going to get so much out of this book. It's just, you go into so much detail, great history lessons of the history of science in here. So yeah, tell us where the best place is for people to grab a copy of this.
Thanks for the kind words about the book. It's available on all the online sellers, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Indie Books, of course, Amazon. And I have a website, a new website that's been built for the book called returnofthegodhypothesis.com, which connects you to my author page. And then from there, you can navigate to the websites for my previous books. And I've got animations and debate videos and all kinds of things on a YouTube channel connected to all that. So if you're interested in this issue, that's a great portal as far as a starting point. So returnofthegodhypothesis.org. And you can go from there. You can click through to purchase as well.
Excellent. I will link that all in the show notes. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you so much for your time today.
And that was Pat Flynn with Stephen C. Meyer in the second half of a conversation hosted on Flynn's own podcast. For more great conversations on evolution and intelligent design, stay in touch with us here at idthefuture.com or follow ID the Future on your preferred podcast app. We really appreciate your doing that. Until next time, then, for ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.